Okay. Hi, welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Harjeet Kaur, and I will be the host and moderator for today's Hinckley-Benyon Forum. The Hinckley Institute of Politics was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. Today's forum is brought to you in partnership with the Lowell Benyon Community Service Center. The Benyon Center fosters lifelong service and civic participation by engaging the university with greater community in action, change, and learning. The Benyon Center's diverse programming ensures there is an opportunity for everyone to become engaged. I specifically am involved today as a moderator because I'm a community-engaged learning scholar. I got involved in my sophomore year initially through my experience with the Ethnic Studies course, where I had the opportunity to mentor students at Jackson Elementary. I have found combining my academic coursework in engineering with viable community engagement opportunities to be highly fulfilling and reciprocal, and a major part of my role as a scholar through learning, changing, and sharing education in collaboration with communities. Because I've been able to apply my knowledge in classes to my work in communities and reflect on that, I have grown as a person, and the Benyon Center has been a support to me throughout. Today we will be discussing community involvement through chemical engineering department. Our panelists today are Dr. Jeff Silcox and James Dennis. So Dr. Silcox is a professor in the Department of Chemical Engineering at the University of Utah. He has served as associate chair since 2000. Before joining the university in 1987, he worked as a research engineer and group leader for energy and environmental research cooperation. His current research interests include air pollution and the chemistry of mercury and combustion of fuel gases. He enjoys teaching, and his current assignments include thermodynamics and air pollution control engineering. James Dennis is a senior in chemical engineering who graduated from Highland High School. He has been researching clean coal combustion for clean and secure energy. He has also been volunteering for Engineers Without Borders. So we will start with some prepared questions, then move into questions from the audiences. So the first question is, why and how is service learning used to support learning in chemical engineering classes?
Well, our department actually has a long history of community engagement, and I've taught air pollution control for years, and I met some of the faculty in atmospheric science, told them that I was teaching air pollution control, and they put me in touch with the Division of Air Quality. This conversation, or this meeting, we catch the bus together, and we're always catching the bus in the dense smog in winter, and so it just naturally led into doing something about air pollution. So I met with DAQ, and we just brainstormed different ideas. This was in the fall of 2010, and we came up with the idea of looking at how the PM 2.5 changes with elevation as you move across the valley. So we ended up putting samplers and from the monitoring station at Hawthorne Elementary. We went from there up into the hills above the avenues. And so the students got a taste of field work, and part of the value, I think, of service learning is that the problems you're working on are open-ended. They're not something that's in your textbook. They don't have nice, neat little answers, so that gives the students the chance to be creative and do different things from what they would usually find in a class.
Pretty much echoing just that. It's always great as an engineer to have a hands-on experience, because most of the time it's you have a table of data from a textbook and you never have to worry about how it got there. So to be able to actually collect the samples and have to worry about how accurate they were and all that, it was a wonderful experience.
Okay, so how has these classes in chemical engineering department helped to address communities in need?
Well, I think all of us are in need when we're faced with the air pollution events that we have in winter. And I think anything we can do to understand them helps. And in particular, part of my motivation for wanting to look at the effects of elevation was I think the people who live on the upper avenues near my house, they think they're out of the worst of it. And so the people all around the valley who live in the most affluent neighborhoods think they are above most of the smog. So part of my motivation was to see whether that's really true as a way to convince people that we all need to worry about it, unless you live in Park City. So based on our measurements, you really need to get up to about Park City or 6,500 feet before you're out of the air pollution during our intense inversions.
And then for the follow-up, didn't you guys look at the source of the emissions as well?
Yeah, the year after that, we found out that DAQ has actually been measuring the composition of the PM2.5 for multiple years. And using statistical techniques, if you have enough data, you can back out what the possible sources are. So we used a statistical package from EPA to do that. And I also had a PhD student work on that with the class as an independent study project. So both of these studies have resulted in publications, and it's been a great experience for me and for the students and for the doctoral student.
And then also, by being able to quantify where things are coming from, you were able to inform policymakers, right?
Yeah. Right.
Or the Department of Air Quality.
Yeah, so we always share our findings with DAQ. And DAQ, one of their scientists, was actually a co-author on this second paper, which talks about sources. And the thing that's remarkable about the data on the sources is that wood smoke appears to be quite a bit more important than was thought previously. So that's has policy implications.
That's all for me.
So from each of your perspectives, can you describe the benefits and challenges of service learning?
Well, as a student, what we were talking about before, it's always great to not have to work out of a book. But you still got to take the principles that you learned within the book and apply it to reality and try to figure out how to affect the world around you.
That echoes what we said before, but I think that one of the biggest challenges is that our students are really busy. They're taking a heavy class load. Many of them are working. Many are married. And it's hard to convince them to take the time and spend it on a project that certainly counts as part of their grade, but it's open-ended and not as clearly defined as something that you would do on a regular exam or in your homework assignment. So I think that's the biggest challenge, is convincing the students that this is something worth doing, and it'll take a little time, but it deserves care and attention.
And also, so. Having to collect the samples at the higher elevations in January and February meant you were hiking in the snow a lot, which didn't have a lot of volunteers for that.
Yeah, it was hard to find people to do that because we had to carry these big batteries up in the mountains, and James was actually one of the few students who was willing to do that.
Yeah.
So what kinds of service are done to fulfill the service requirements for the chemical engineering service learning class? I know you discussed that it's like an open project, but is there more?
Well,
I could elaborate on that.
We've talked about the first two projects from 11 and 12. This year we're looking at hazardous air pollutant data that DAQ has collected in Bountiful. So DAQ has a monitoring station at the, what's the high school there? Viewmont High School. And they're monitoring dozens of hazardous air pollutants. So these include things like carbon tetrachloride and methylene chloride and different solvents. And it turns out that about 15 of them exceed the EPA screening values. I think that's the correct term, screening values, for cancer and chronic effects. So the, and this is based on 8-year averages. And in looking at the data, there are just huge spikes. So most of the exceedances, these compounds that are above the EPA screening values, it's not because there's a steady low level of something. It's because we're getting great big spikes. And so our assignment from DAQ and as part of this class is to try to figure out where those are coming from. And how are they correlated with our inversions? Do they correlate with CO emissions? I hope the students are actually looking at the neighboring businesses that are around the school to see what's there. So I know there's an RV repair shop, which probably uses methylene chloride to degrease parts. And maybe they're not handling their solvents well. Anyway, that's what we're doing this year.
Yeah. Okay. So as a student and a professor, how do you feel that combining chemical engineering and service learning as a course, how is it more beneficial versus a regular course?
Do you want me to start or do you want to?
Go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, as we've said before, hands-on experience is very important, and it's always great as an engineer to be able to get outside of the lab, because that doesn't happen very often. But also, it encourages creative thinking, so it's not just mindlessly moving through equations without thinking of their implications. And it also helps to foster a greater view of society. So how can you as an engineer help to benefit the world around you? And these are all very important for us, especially as we're moving forward into affecting the world and different plants as we graduate.
So our third guest is actually here. Patrick, do you want to come up and join us?
Good afternoon. I apologize, everybody. I didn't leave quite enough time for some unforeseen events. So.
We want to welcome Mr. Patrick Brickman. So thank you for coming.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry I'm here a little late.
No, it's... So maybe if you could kind of go through all the questions we've asked, but talk more about this, about service learning and how.
Microphone here.
Is that good? Does everybody hear me? Just in listening to the questions as I was here, and especially the last couple, what I was thinking about, especially the. Actually, Jeff, I didn't know that this year you were looking at the HAPS because my involvement has been more with the Atmospheric Science Department. But, that's a really important project. I call it HAPS, Hazardous Air Pollutants. And so we have this one monitor in Bountiful where it's actually a part of a national network of monitors that monitor volatile organic compounds. And it's one thing to monitor them, but then to every 6 days we send this data off to a lab, and this is an EPA lab, and it's the data is speciated, so it's where we find out the different compounds that make up this suite of organic compounds that we're monitoring, and there's literally I believe hundreds of different volatile organics, and we. As a part of this national network that EPA has to look at this across the country, I think they look at, I can't remember how many dozen different compounds, but we have, we don't really have the expertise or the time at the agency to really go into it in the kind of depth that even just that Jeff just mentioned. So from a And personally, in my own experience at DAQ, I think that those emissions are some of the most significant in terms of the public health implications. And so the ability to, or the benefit that we get from this kind of service learning is actually having students who are interested, intelligent, and as a part of their assignment, really look into this in depth, gives us, you know, just, it's very helpful for us. It's very helpful for the community, ultimately. And the project that Jeff mentioned that they did in setting these monitors out at these different elevations, this was, we inferred certain things just based on what we know about inversions and the different layers of an inversion and things like that. But it really wasn't until the class, you know, set these monitors out, did this very systematic analysis of what was being measured during an inversion that we got these very quantifiable information about kind of the stratification of pollution through the valley. So those were the couple things that I thought. I mean, it is very, very useful and important work for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so the remainder of the time we would like to devote for questions from the audience. And I will come around with the microphone, so could you state your name and major and speak directly into the mic? So if there's any questions.
Hi, Sean Kenny. I'm a political science major here at the U. My question is, you know, we hear a lot of times in the wintertime that reducing driving is a major thing. What are some of the other, you know, I guess like the top five maybe pollutants that we, you know, for instance, I think you mentioned like wood burning. What are some of those other things that are contributing to this the problem?
Well, there are certainly vehicle emissions of all types, and when you start looking at those emissions, it turns out that about 60% of them come from your car when it's cold. So when your car's just been sitting for a few hours and the catalytic converter is cold, the converter won't do anything to control the emissions, and it's those catalytic converters that are really critical for reducing emissions from our cars. So one practical thing that we could do as individuals is if you have to run errands, you do them in a chain so that your car never really gets cold. So you'd save up all your errands and then run them all at once in a chain. It also turns out that a lot of the particulate in the atmosphere is not emitted directly. It actually forms in the atmosphere. So the major constituent of our PM2.5 is actually ammonium nitrate, which is a great fertilizer. But it's forming in the atmosphere from ammonia reacting with nitric acid. The nitric acid ultimately comes from combustion sources primarily. So whenever you burn a fuel at high temperature, some of the nitrogen in the air, and certainly some of the nitrogen in the fuel, is converted to NO, nitric oxide, and that is subsequently oxidized in the atmosphere to form nitric acid, and that contributes to acid rain, but it also forms ammonium nitrate. So what can we do about that? DAQ has measured ammonia levels during our inversions and discovered that there's plenty of ammonia around, and it's never what's limiting. So we always have excess ammonia during the inversions. And then the question is, where is that coming from? I'm not really sure. I mean, it comes from animal waste, but we don't exactly have tons of animals in the valley. It might be partly coming from the Great Salt Lake. Part of it might be from the fertilizer we put on our lawns. So we might be adding to the problem by fertilizing our lawns? I don't know.
Well, just so the ammonia inventory, we call it, we inventory these different compounds. And there's a lot of uncertainty across the board. There's probably more in the ammonia inventory than any of the others. And that's not just true here locally. That's true across the country. It's a difficult, I'm not sure what all the different ramifications of why. It's just a very difficult part of the inventory to get a handle on. But as Jeff said, it seems to be in just about any area, you wouldn't expect a lot of ammonia in an urban area. I know that one source of it, I don't know how large it is, but actually the catalytic converters in cars, there's some amount of ammonia that comes out of that. But there's, we estimate ammonia by a various, we kind of go to a handbook in a way. It says, it gives you just different factors for different pollutants if it's not well known about them. And, I know there's household products and a whole range of things that we estimate it from, so we don't really have a good handle on what's coming in. So we don't really, when we're trying to analyze how to really deal with our PM2.5 problem here in the inversion, we're not focusing on ammonia because we figure that that we couldn't really take enough out to stop that reaction. And so it comes back to the NOx, the NOx that we call it. But also apparently, from what we understand, and it was a surprise to us, but more and more, both from what we see in our own modeling work, what we read in the literature, is that the volatile organics, which you usually don't think about as being a related to ammonium nitrate, it actually does play a part, and it plays a part in the complex chemistry, and that is the photochemical reactions that produce ozone can increase the nitric acid, which is what combines with the ammonia to form the ammonium nitrate, and so that's kind of a daytime pathway. So that's why, it's very, getting back to your original question, we have a particularly difficult issue here during an inversion for two reasons. One, we have the secondary production of the particulates, and beyond the chemistry, we have the inversion conditions that even when we remove a lot of pollutants out of here, there's still plenty here to react and go through this chemical process and build up the concentrations. And where you see that much more pronounced than here is in Logan, is up in the Cache Valley, because if you think about it, we have a million or more people in this valley. They have about 100,000. So there's roughly one-tenth of the emissions that are going into these two different valleys. But there, there are fewer outlets from the valley once an inversion sets in, and so, and yet when they get strong inversions, they'll get levels of PM2.5 from this chemistry-driven process that's hot, as high or higher than it is down here.
Hi. Political science major. My name is Nick Sartain. I got a question about personal, reduction. Is there anything we can do to, or devices or otherwise that we can do to limit our exposure? Masks, home mechanics.
There are certainly filters that you can install in your house. So they can be filters for rooms. So they circulate the air within a room through a filter. You can also have high-efficiency filters installed on your furnace. I don't know if you'd want to wear a mask while you're walking around, but that would help.
Are there masks that would reduce?
Oh, yes.
Not small paper ones, though.
I'm not really sure how effective those would be, but I'm sure there are devices available that would work for industrial protection. So workers who have to protect themselves from fumes and things, they have masks that they can wear, and you could wear one too, but it would look very strange.
Hi, Elliot Hodson, astrophysics major. When you said about the RV cleaning, when they use their chemicals and you said they might have not have disposed them properly, doesn't the EPA have regulations against chemicals like that and how you should dispose of them?
Of course. I'm just speculating on what a possible problem would be, but maybe they just let their solvent evaporate rather than paying to have it incinerated or disposed of properly. I'm just guessing.
Is there not a lot of regulation on things like that?
Well, there is, but with these smaller companies, it's rather hard to regulate. And it's partly just limitations in DAQ's resources. They can't check every little print shop or paint shop or RV repair shop. So that's a real problem.
Tyler Chapman, I'm a physics major. And my question is, what are the motives behind and the effects of chemtrails that we're sort of dispersing in our skies?
Do you know
much
about
I don't know much. What are the motives, did you say?
Yeah, the motives behind and the effects of.
Tell me your understanding of chemtrails, because I honestly don't know that much about it. I've heard about it. I've heard about what they... I mean, isn't that where... It's a sense that it's not the contrails that come from jets, but something else?
Yes, it's something else that we're intentionally, from what I've seen, and that's why I asked the question, because I'd like to clarify a little bit, and it's where we sort of disperse chemical compounds out into the skies, which are mostly non-organic and, I believe, aluminum-based. And I've heard theories that they reflect some of the sun's rays that are depleting the ozone layer back into space, and that's what I've heard, but I was hoping to understand more.
You know, I don't know that much about it. When you say we, who... In fact, I know just about nothing about it, so...
We as in our country, our government.
You know, I don't know. So, yeah.
Yeah, I also haven't heard about that.
No.
Geoengineering. Well, yeah, it's called geoengineering. So people are talking about putting balloons in the atmosphere and reflectors and releasing... SO2 to help block some of the sunlight and prevent global warming. Maybe that's what you're referring to. I don't know that any of that's actually going on intentionally.
Hi, I'm Satine. I'm a political science major and also pre-med. And my question for you is if you can institute one piece of legislation to promote the health of the planet, what would you propose and why?
Do you want to take me? I don't know if I'd want to look at the whole planet, but maybe if we just looked at Salt Lake City, a possible policy would be to require all new wood stoves to be EPA certified. So if you were to buy a new stove, you would have to buy one that was EPA certified. And I know some communities like Fairbanks, Alaska, they're actually the community or the government is providing subsidies so that people will replace their old dirty wood-burning stoves with new EPA-certified stoves. And I think they can get up to $3,000 to do that. And then they're taking the old stoves and destroying them so that nobody will use them. That might help us here in Salt Lake. There are some people who their only source of heat is wood burning. And if those people don't have to stop burning during the inversions. And if they could be converted over to more efficient stoves, it would help. So that's a possible policy action.
You know, there is some element of that actually being put in place as a part of this PM 2.5 state implementation plan that we've done for Cache County. We're trying to finish for down here, which is related specifically to, and I can't, it's fairly detailed because it's a regulation that the Air Quality Board passes that has to do with things like even putting into building permit or zoning and building and zoning about what you can, how, if you build a new house, what sort of heating, like, in fact, I don't think we even allow any kind of wood-burning fireplace now. It's just gas. So we've taken that step. Also, just to add to what Jeff said, I think what's really important in terms of health and starting kind of locally is this issue with hazardous air pollutants. And there's a number of reasons why that's a very difficult issue to tackle, but one of them is the quantities are so small that it's actually hard to measure, for one thing, to really know kind of what's out there. But there is an EPA has a program for hazardous air pollutants for both inventorying them and rules on manufacturing and thing controls that somebody brought up earlier about, you know, how these things are disposed of. But I think in Utah we're limited in what we do just by resources, as Jeff mentioned. And I think that were we to put more focus in that area, I think that would be potentially really beneficial just health wise.
Hi, my name is Noel DeNevers. I'm a retired professor. Many of the environmental groups have pointed their finger very markedly at the refineries in Kennecott. Does your data support the idea that they're really the major cause of the problem?
It doesn't. I mean, at least if in terms of the it doesn't. It doesn't, and I'll tell you why. So there was a lot of controversy this winter that sort of in the media about our estimates of where the sources of pollution are coming from, and the big one was this our statement that 11% of the pollution that is related to the PM2.5 problem, which is NOx, the volatile organic compounds. SO2 or SOx and the fine direct particulates comes from all major sources, not just the refineries in Kennecott, but the gravel pits, whatever. We have 80 different sources in the whole state, and in the non-attainment area up here in northern Utah, there are 35 major sources. And if you look at the four, Utah, Salt Lake, Davis, and Weber County, and also Tooele and Box Elder, but Tooele and Box Elder, things like I can't think of the steel plant that's up there, Nucor. So major sources, it's 11% of what's going into the atmosphere. So into our local atmosphere during the winter in a typical kind of winter inversions. And so from that perspective. You know, I don't think they're the major source. They're a player, but we could. I'm not going to throw out a number because it's just coming off the top of my head. We could remove or control really significant portions of those of the of Kennecott and the refineries, and we'd still have a PM2.5 problem during the inversion.
Hi, my name is Jefferson Campbell. I'm a gender studies student here at the university. My question is about your ties to the Benyon Center. I was wondering if you could give a little bit more of a background as one who doesn't have a lot of experience with the Benyon Center on what service learning is and who exactly can get involved, like if students outside of chemical engineering can get involved in these different programs or what is really available there.
So the Do you?
Start. We will add
to it. Okay, well, certainly this community-engaged learning is open to all disciplines across campus. And the Binion Center also has a wealth of volunteer opportunities that are not associated with coursework necessarily. So there's things like the alternative spring break, and there are others that I am not that familiar with. But I think in chemical engineering, it's because of this air pollution class. That's the reason we got involved. That's the reason I got involved. And there have been other engineering departments that have done community engagement programs. For example, I think civil engineering was involved in designing a bridge that's part of the Bonneville Shoreline Trail, part of the bridge that goes over Parley's Canyon, I think. I'm not actually familiar with that. So I think we have all these opportunities, and sometimes we just don't think of how we might take what we're doing and apply it to serving the community. So sometimes you have to step outside your box and think broadly.
And then there's also opportunities with other organizations, not necessarily just within the class, but also like Engineers Without Borders. It's called Engineers, but we'll take anybody. So over this last spring break, we went down to the Indian Reservation to help build a house. So most of us were engineering majors, but there was actually a couple others who, I'm not sure what their majors were, but something else. So, yeah, there's opportunities as well.
I could also chip in on that. I'm a community engaged learning scholar, and I've taken two or three courses on service learning or community engagement learning. And it's really a format for you to apply the education you've gained from your experiences in college or life and applying them through service to change a community in a way that you think you could apply your knowledge and better the community. Because as scholars, that's our job, to go out of the University of Utah community and, you know, impact communities all around.
My name is Patricio Panuncio. I'm a political science and sociology major. I'm just wondering if you could talk a little more about the current regulations in our state that promote better air quality.
Well, so just at a well, let me give you one example that probably most of you maybe haven't thought of. So there's a, in northeastern Utah, there's what we call the Uinta Basin, Uinta and Deschene counties. And that's as many of you may know, it's a very large industrial area now where there's a great deal of natural gas, there's been oil development there for many years. But in the last 10 years especially, there's been a really large increase in natural gas production. It's also been happening in southwest Wyoming, northeast of Denver. So a lot of natural gas development. And what we found in southwest Wyoming and in the Uinta Basin is that there are very high levels of ozone pollution during the winter, and that's a really unusual combination. We've always thought of there's a number of things that are unusual about that combination. That's always been considered an urban problem, and it's also always been considered a problem during the summertime. And that, again, same way our PM problem here comes from atmospheric chemistry. Ozone is also atmospheric chemistry. It's not emitted as ozone, it's related to the interaction of ultraviolet light and VOC and NOx, the same pollutants. But what we're doing to try and be as proactive as we can is to try and get at this point, the regulations have to be voluntary because we haven't exceeded a federal health standard, which is what then requires laws that come into play. And so we're trying to work in a with the communities out there, and also but also the producers, the oil and gas companies, to change the way they're doing business now, so that they begin to reduce the emissions from that activity, and try and get try and mitigate the problem before they exceed the health standard, then it becomes law and that sort of thing. So that's one example that I can think of. There, in general, just one more thing: the way our laws are structured, and this is from the federal level, is there for these certain. There's a half a dozen pollutants. We monitor for those. There's a standard set in terms of how much can be in the air on either over 24 hours or averaged over a year. And when those levels are exceeded, then it starts a process in that then does have the force of law of putting regulations on to try and lower those levels.
Hi, my name is Trent Clifford, and I'm a freshman here at the U studying Parks and Recreation. With all that you have said, do you think that there's going to be any improvement over the year, like just in general, over the next coming years, do you think there's going to be any improvement during the wintertime?
I guess, should I start?
Sure.
Okay. How about it? I'm going to answer that in two ways. One is that the things that we have control over, which is the pollution that comes from our economic activity. You might be surprised. I was really surprised by this, actually, and I've been working there for 20 years, but just this winter when we were really trying to partly address public concerns and things that were coming to us, I went back and I looked at what we call our emissions inventory, so what we estimate is going into the atmosphere on an annual basis. And then we kind of convert that into a daily basis. But I looked at that in kind of basically sort of wintertime conditions, and I looked at 2002 when we had done some modeling, we had an estimate, and then 2008 and to 2011. And what really surprised me is we have there is a lot less pollution going into this into the Wasatch Front than there was 10 years ago, and I don't know. Hadn't really thought about it, but I mean, a lot like in terms of like 25% to 40% less. So that's a really big reduction, and yet we still have these really high levels of pollution when we get an inversion. This year was particularly bad. If you remember back to last winter of 2011-2012, it was generally warmer. We had some inversions, but nothing like we had this year, and the levels of pollution weren't anywhere nearly as high the few days that it did go above. So we are always going to be challenged in staying below this national health standard when we get an inversion. And it goes back to what I said earlier, which is when the air gets that stagnant, it's not really able to mix out. You just keep, our daily activity, we keep putting more in, and it will just kind of build up, convert chemically, and build up.
Is there any more questions?
Tim Chambliss, I teach in political science. A statement and a question. My statement is, last December and last March, I was in Southern California for a week each time, a place where when I have memories as a youth of having days where you could not see down the block. The air was yellow, brown, much like what I've seen in Beijing, China. Flying back into this valley, I saw pollution that reminded me of Los Angeles 40, 50 years ago. And it's last December, last March. Gave a real face to the statistics we're seeing, comparing Utah nationwide to the problems we have. Question is, if Governor Herbert were here, if the members of the state legislature were here, given the fact they're not members of the federal government but still are state officials, what would you say to them about how
your suggestions to solve or confront this very real public policy problem? What should they do? What would you say to them? I know you've talked to the Department of Air Quality, but what would you say to the governor and to members of the State Senate and State House? Because we have people dying of these problems of air pollution. It may not be right in front of us with immediate heart attacks, but people are dying.
So maybe I'll answer that like a professor. I think if we knew that the real health costs and economic costs of our air pollution, I think if we could quantify those, that would be a major tool for convincing the governor and the legislature to change policy, to maybe tighten up on vehicle emissions, try to get clunkers off the road, maybe regulate smaller businesses more carefully. I don't think they're going to really listen unless they can see the economic and health impact. And, of course, the health impact is related to economics as well. So that's not really an engineering problem. That's more of a health and economics and policy problem. And I don't know how else to address it. There's a
Tim, I'll give you an answer to that question that I gave to Governor Leavitt about 10 years ago. If we double the number of people living in the Salt Lake Valley, and we want to just hold even on pollution, then we have to cut the number of pollution per person by a factor of 2, which is not going to be simple. So the other alternative is not to double the number of people in the Salt Lake Valley. Now, no politician can say that. It's utterly unspeakable to say out loud that you could have too many people somewhere, or too much industry, or too much growth. But ultimately, we have to think about that. And Governor Leavitt smiled and said, thanks.
May I follow up?
I can remember you coming and testifying before the Salt Lake City Board of Adjustment when I was chair and on the Planning Commission for years. So planning, long-term, is very important to me. And I can tell you that we've looked at long-range plans to increase the population in this valley by at least 50% over the next 30 years. Now, we're at 37% in 2010 with the census. We think we're at 40% of the state's population right now, a little over 1 million. We have plans to increase the population in this valley, this county, the largest county in the state, by at least 50% in about 3 decades. Over 550,000 people on the West Bench coming in. Now that's going to raise questions about transportation, water, pollution matters, water and sewer concerns, power, electricity, so forth. Those are the plans. People are coming here. We're one of the fastest growing states per capita, GDP, in the country. People are coming. And the question is, how are we going to be able to manage this and not foul our nest so that we're going to have more and more people in a confined space bumping into each other with greater frequency and dying?
Down because I feel more comfortable sitting down. Thank you for being here. I came in a few minutes late, so this may have been covered. My name is Gina Russo, and I'm the assistant director at the Benyon Center and adjunct faculty member in political science. But more importantly, I am a year-round bicycle commuter, and I like to be outdoors a lot. And I have wanted to go back, because anecdotally, kind of to go back on his question, I don't think the air is getting better in the last 4.5 years that I've been here. And I would like to be able to access data on that. So I can't find that on the DEQ website anywhere. So I can see what's happening today and what's forecasted, but I can't go back when I moved here in 2008 and the January of 2009 was so horrific that I would have wheezing for 2 hours after walking 15 minutes because I was in the cloud forest in Costa Rica and it was like canary to the coal mine.
I thought I was going to have to leave. So I'm wondering if there's any way that anyone like myself, just a regular old citizen, could access that data so that we could have the information that might affect the planning, that might affect the policy about the air quality.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of data out there. Now, we don't have it on our site like you're asking for. There have been studies, though, that have looked at, and I guess there's two things. One, I'm not sure really if you want to just sort of see trends or if.
Yeah, I kind of want to be able to say, well, in January of 2009, there were X number of red days and X number of yellow days. And this is what the numbers were, because I look at the little thermometer every day, you uh-huh. know. And it seems to me like we're having more and more what you call red and yellow days, and that the numbers are getting higher and higher on that little thermometer and sometimes going like to the top. So that's kind of what I wanted to be able to compare. So if I could just look at a chart that says, you know, this is how it's going, or this is what the days were, or January 22nd, 2009, this is what it was, you know, that kind of a thing where I could just look at it from year to year, month to month.
Well, there's something called there's a site called Air Now, which is a national, it's done by EPA, and they might have an archive of data. I'm just thinking of something that, you know, you could go back to your web browser and say Air Now, and you'd get to the site. The other thing is that data is available. It's just kind of in raw form, and it sort of takes a lot to work with, so I'm kind of hesitant on that. You know, I will say, though, just in general, we've done some trends where we've looked at things like not whether it was red or yellow or something, but just looking back over, say, 20 years, really, the number of days where we exceeded the standard and that kind of thing. And I just say this just because it's what our trends show. I mean, it is going down, and it may be slight, but and that's an average and that sort of a thing. But that's anyway, that's it. That's an answer to your question about whether it's going up or down. It depends on how you look at it. There's a lot of data. It's just not that you have to go to EPA, actually, and it's online, of all this archived data. You could also, I'd be happy to give you my card. I could put you in touch with somebody in my office who could actually get you that data. We just don't have it on our website to sort of pull.
It would just be interesting. And I think what has happened in the last 20 years might be, perhaps, I don't know, a downward trend. But I'm wondering if what's happened in the last 5 years might be a little different. And maybe when you put all those 20 years together, it comes out as a downward trend. But I'm wondering if you just looked at the last five. I don't know. Yeah. It would just be fun to look at the data and see what it is, because I do think that kind of data, if it, and I understand it takes a lot of time, but if you can pull that together, that does, I think, affect planning and policy. And that helps us find the health an economic piece, I think, maybe that you guys were talking about as well. So,
sure.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
Hi, my name is Tim Bargsley. I'm with the Western Water Assessment. I just have a couple questions going back to some earlier statements that you made. One, with the elevational gradient study that you did, you said basically a 6,500-foot level, more or less, to be above the inversion. But did you find any trends along that elevation? If you're at 5,000 feet or 5,500 feet, for example, is it lower?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely lower. And maybe at about 6,000 feet, you're maybe 30% lower.
Okay.
But you really need to get over 6,500 feet to pop out of the dense pollution.
Okay, thank you for that. And one very other very quick question. On the wood burning, you mentioned that there's quite a few homes in the valley that are still reliant on wood heat. I wonder if you have an idea what the percentage of that is.
I don't. Do you?
We don't. In fact, that's surprising data to us because you know, 20 years ago, we did a plan for PM10 at that time, and that was where we really looked at wood burning. Not only looked at it, but put we put the whole process of no burn and that thing into place. Gave credits for changing out your stoves to EPA certified ones and stuff. And we have really assumed that that participation, when we say, you know, this isn't, we call it an action day now, that people have really, you know, took that to heart and didn't burn. And so that's why that's really interesting data to see a wood smoke signal in the speciation. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't have any data on how many people are heating their homes that way.
It just seems like that could be low-hanging fruit if it's a very small percentage for regulatory action and for incentives to changing out to natural gas, heat, or something else.
And I think there are places like Missoula, Montana, I think for the last 12 years, maybe 15 years, no wood burning, period.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's essentially one of our of the regulations that is going to be a part of this plan that we're putting in place. And the way we're doing that, we're not saying you can't burn during the winter, but the threshold of when we call that will be the pollution levels will be so much lower. It'll be based on a forecast that it essentially if people participate with that, that's our intent.
Okay, if you would like to further be involved in your community, please participate to our next Saturday service project, April 20th, at Bend in the River. For details, please visit the Bennion Center website at benioncenter.org. So please join me in thanking our panelists for coming today. Thank you.